And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Just the other day, I commented to someone that at least the hurricane season was over. Wrong. Hurricane Wilma is on its way into the Gulf Coast with projections for landfall in Florida. Wilma is the biggest so far. It's like someone is trying to give us no excuse whatsoever to ignore the warnings. Will anyone benefit from this? Actually, in today's show, we will announce a real opportunity for you to win $3,000 if you put together the best answer. There is a little catch, and you'll find out what that is when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a lot of hard work being in the news business. I had this great show planned that was going to take our minds off the disasters sweeping around the world, and then out of the blue water of the Atlantic, Hurricane Wilma materializes. It's true, no one can prove that global climate change is actually happening because climates change by their very nature. Global warming is now a term that no one wants to hear about because the debate is as challenging as the apparent results. But below all the brouhaha are some of the facts that science cannot debate. CO2 is increasing in our atmosphere. We have had three of the hottest years on record in the last four, and we just set a record for most hurricanes in a single season. And so, today, we accept the hard-edged truth that such is the state of the world, and give ourselves a little break. I'm sure that's okay with most of you. So during our first segment, following the news, we're going to check in at two national parks to hear how the animals are adapting to the changes, actually the natural changes, that happen this time each year as winter approaches. So it's up to the Badlands of South Dakota, then down to the ancient dwellings of Chaco. Now here's something fun. Challenging, and if done right, could really help turn our country around, but most important to you, do it right, and you've got a $3,000 bill in your pocket. That's absolutely true. We helped to launch a great idea sponsored by EI2025.org, which is holding an audition for songwriters to write the best tune for tuning up our energy future. It's open to anyone, and that includes you. And then, in segment three, I'm demanding that each of you do exactly what I say, because it will get you so in touch with things that matter. And it's so easy, and this is the time to do it. I'm conducting my fourth on-air art class to get you to take a walk, take a look at your changing world, choose some leaves, and learn to draw them. Now don't cop out on me, stick with me on this one. You'll be glad you did. So we best throttle up and get on to the news, and then on with the show. So first, the news. In a recent Harris poll sponsored by the Wall Street Journal, Americans overwhelmingly agree that protecting the environment is important and standards cannot be too high. Nearly three-quarters of U.S. adults surveyed supported strict protections. The same poll concludes that 71% of those responsible for environmental problems are large corporations, while at the same time, 63% said the general public is not doing its share. Water pollution topped the list of concerns, with air pollution and global warming next in rank. The survey also concluded that 42% of Americans feel that environmental groups are doing more than their share, while 44% said the media was doing less than their share. And while only 12% of respondents classified themselves as environmentalists, 58% said they were sympathetic to environmental concerns. The Senate Energy Committee voted Wednesday to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil drilling as part of a broad budget bill to help fund the federal government. In an end-around move, the energy panel agreed to attach the ANWR drilling provision to the budget bill because it cannot be filibustered. The provision was passed 13-9, with all Republicans and two Democrats, Mary Landrieu and Daniel Akaka, voting in favor of the bill. Democratic leaders are expected to raise objections to the bill's provisions. Although the bill authorizes no more than 2,000 acres of land usage in the ANWR area, the impact can be very widespread as pipelines can form a matrix extending for many miles while taking up little land. The bill, which has been touted as a means to help the U.S. meet its oil and energy needs, amazingly includes a provision which permits selling of Alaskan oil to China or other foreign nations. Democrat Ron Wyden introduced a proposal to ban such transshipment, but his proposal was defeated. The Senate is expected to debate the budget bill next week and vote on the bill the following week. Last week, the Wildside News reported on the policy changes, which were written by Assistant Deputy Interior Secretary Paul Hoffman, that promoted widespread increases in motorized vehicles such as snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles on public lands. However, after review, the National Park Service has backed off of the Hoffman changes, releasing a draft proposal which maintains and protects more of the historic intent of protecting national parks in a relatively pristine condition. The Hoffman proposal would have expanded the use of snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles on federal lands, and it proposed that in order for activities to be prohibited in parks, they must be something that irreversibly harms the parks instead of only harming them. Park Service officials said the new drafts would leave current snowmobile and off-road regulations in place, and the word irreversibly has been removed. The new policy will be reviewed by the Senate Energy Subcommittee on National Parks November 1st. In an aggressive push by the Bush administration to open more public land to oil and gas production, the Interior Department has quit conducting environmental reviews and seeking comments from local residents every time drilling companies propose new wells. These relaxed permitting restrictions will apply to BLM lands close to existing projects, which are less than 150 acres and no more than 5 acres in any one spot where nearby drilling has occurred in the past 5 years. The new policies will streamline the permitting of hundreds of new geothermal, gas, and oil wells and are targeted for quick implementation on open ranges and the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, specifically the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, the Uinta Basin of Utah, the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, and areas adjacent to Colorado's Ancients National Monument. Meanwhile, new reports from Europe and now Russia indicate that the bird flu is spreading quickly. And as we speak, yet another major hurricane, perhaps the largest on record, in the Atlantic, pokes its swirling chaos into the Gulf of Mexico again. And that's the news. And a few reminders. We've got a whole lot of new listeners. Now, if you want to receive our weekly email that gives you a heads up on what the upcoming show is about, I want you to send me an email at wildsidenews@cox.net and let me know you want to get the weekly update. That's wildsidenews@cox.net, wildsidenews@cox.net. And feel free to tell me a little bit about you, what you'd like to hear, some story ideas. I love to hear from my listeners. Now, we've got a great show. Change. It's being forced upon us at such rapid speed it sometimes is hard to adapt. Well, in the wild creatures are having to adapt to the changes that the seasons bring. And I talked with a couple of national park folks about what they're noticing from the field. We begin in Badlands National Park in South Dakota, then head on down to one of my favorite parks, what many refer to as Chaco Canyon.
My name is Aaron Kay. I'm a park ranger at Badlands National Park in South Dakota. And, observations that I see throughout the course of the year, especially from summer into winter, I think most noticeable would first be bird life. And, of course, migrant birds that you begin to see moving through, coming from the north, heading south. spending nights over on some of the stock dams throughout the area, not just in the park, but outside of the park. Noticing the disappearance of many of the songbirds, turkey vultures leaving for the season and heading south. The reduction in the bat population as they migrate out of the area. And some distinctive species that in the avian aspect that you might see changing here through the season would be all the migrant waterfowl, but one most remarkable would be the sandhill cranes. And usually sometime around mid-October we'll see them flying across the sky, wheeling through the air, trying to gain altitude and hear their chortling as they pass us by, and it's a sign of winter soon to come. Other things we notice in the park include, of course, the changing of the coats with the animals, going from a thinner winter coat to a thicker, or a thinner summer coat to a winter coat that's a little bit thicker. Animals will often move from summer areas into winter areas. Bighorn sheep tend to rut in the early winter, and we begin to see them across from the visitor center in one of their main rutting areas starting sometime in mid to late October. Populations like the bison in the park, of course, their coats increase in thickness. You see the calves change from their orange color as newborn calves into a more brownish color as the winter turns. And in addition to that, of course, you see the antlers growing on the bucks in the rutting season for the deer, both the whitetail and the mule deer.
Just curious, too, in terms of sort of movements and behaviors, the summer is kind of a lazy time, and different animals are able to find food probably more easily. Just curious if you're observing any sort of changes in as food sources become more scarce.
Well, you know, that's actually a good question. You know, what you don't really see a lot of movement in that sense other than maybe particular food sources that are still green. So you'll see animals gravitating to areas you know, like riparian areas or wetland areas along creek drainages, maybe into some of the river valleys in the area. And some of the last green grass in the area typically is along the sides of the roads. So one of the things that we see an increase of around here at this time of the year is deer commonly along the sides of the road into the evening. And unfortunately outside of the park, probably one of the number one roadkill that we begin to see in the fall into the winter are deer, and it's often because they're feeding on that still green grass along the edges of the road.
You mentioned that bats are migrating. How do you observe that?
Well, we don't really see the bats migrate. What we notice, of course, is, you know, under every light here in the housing area and around the park, you know, during the summer months, you'll see the insects, and you know, spinning underneath the light, and you'll see bats weaving in and out of that light shaft, picking up bugs. And of course, as fall comes into play, you see less and less of those critters. And about this time of the year, we're really only seeing just occasional bats anymore. I don't see many under the lights, but on a regular night, you might see as many as a half a dozen at each light, just kind of swooping in and out of it, going after moths and other insects.
And how is your the weather shaping up at this point in the season?
Well, this year, you know, we had a pretty good moisture. We've been in a drought for a number of years. This year we had good moisture in the spring, and that kind of carried through the summer. What we're seeing as far as temperatures is kind of an extension of Indian summer. We're at a low 80s today here in the Badlands, and that's kind of warm even for October. Conditions have been relatively dry. We have had no real hard freezes as of yet, so the colors that are slowly changing on some of the deciduous trees is slower than usual. Some years you'll see it happen right after a hard frost, and this year without that, we've just kind of seen a slow trend to the color of yellow and leaves slowly kind of drifting off the trees around the park.
Now that's kind of unusual for your area, isn't it?
Usually we get some sort of cold snap that comes through and kind of tends to really kick things into gear, getting, you know, of course, plants and animals ready for winter. But this year, the two big storms passed to the north and the south of us. Colorado got a pretty good storm about 2 weeks ago, and North Dakota got a pretty good storm more like 3 weeks ago. And we just got a little bit of rain out of it and no hard freeze. So it's a little unusual. We get temperature mood swings from as much as 50 below in the winter to 116 in the summer. And fall and spring are really nice times of the year because the temperatures are pretty moderate.
Now, are you open all year round?
Yep, we're open all year round. Scenic Loop Road in the park is about 30 miles long. It includes beautiful scenery, the park, the Badlands formations, as well as the wildlife, and a trip out onto Sage Creek Rim Road, which is a gravel road which skirts the north boundary of the wilderness area, provides views of the wilderness area, and also our bison herd, which is about almost 1,000 strong.
It's a great, amazing, rugged park that is it's appropriately called the Badlands.
That's correct. You know, Badlands are found in other places in the world. It's a geologic term, but the type site for the geologic term is right here in Badlands National Park in South Dakota.
Thanks so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
You bet. My pleasure.
We continue our journey around America to see what's happening with the wild creatures, and we're focusing on national parks today. And so joining us from one of my all-time most favorite national parks in the entire universe is Brad Shattuck, who's the Chief of Natural Resources at Chaco Culture National Historical Park, one of the most amazing places in the world. Brad, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you. Thrilled to be here. Thanks.
First of all, give me a sense of what's happening down there in the Southwest.
In the Southwest in the fall, it's really a wonderful dynamic period, meaning it's changing quite a bit with the fall season as it approaches. You have birds starting to leave the canyon. The flora begins to turn yellow and brown and red. You have rainstorms that occur generally at least a number of times during the week at this time of year. And you can start to feel a bit of the frostbite as winter begins its slow but steady onset.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about those details, but let's talk a little bit about Chaco Canyon itself, which is such an amazing place and so important in American history, and actually in Mesoamerican history. Anyone who visits Chaco will be overwhelmed by its story. Give us a brief version of that.
Oh, certainly. Well, first, let me tell you where we're located, and we're a rather large park at 34,000 acres. And we're located in a very remote corner of northwest New Mexico. In fact, it's one of the only parks in the lower 48 that I know of that's entrance road is still unpaved. It's a bumpy ride in, and you get a wilderness experience once you arrive. However, once you're here, you're going to open up into essentially what is known as New York of 1,000 years ago. Mm. This is New York City. This is where this place was hopping 1,000 years ago. What we refer to as the Chacoan culture people. These people, who are essentially the ancestors of today's American Pueblo people, built these massive, huge, massive ruins, one of which covers 8 acres in size, known as Pueblo Bonito. They lived here for approximately 300 years before eventually moving on. And in some cases, the preservation of these buildings ranges from remarkable to, well, the building looks like 1,000 years old. So when you come out here, you're going to be overawed by the wilderness experience and your ability to tour these buildings on your own and at your own pace, or with a ranger guided tour if you want.
I've been out to Chaco many times. I actually spent one night stuck on the road following a rainstorm on my attempts to get out there because it turned into caliche, and then I was stuck and couldn't move. It's a relatively isolated, but it's a deep canyon followed surrounded by bluffs, and I share with you so much that vision of this place being a very metropolitan zone at that time. I oftentimes, as I've, for example, been on top of one of the bluffs, and there's an area that feels like it's like a little water pool, and I've often imagined people in the moonlight being up there, sort of lounging around in a water bath, and then just walking around that beautiful place. There's how many different structures?
The massive Great House ruins. How many are there?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay. The Great House ruins that at least you can visit. There are 14. Total of the largest great house sites. Now, Chaco Canyon, though, if you had that figure in your head, would be a little misleading, because there are over 4,000 archaeological sites located in Chaco Canyon.
Right.
And in some cases, when they did these site surveys, it was fairly arbitrary in what they were calling the site. So defining the boundaries of the site is sometimes the problem, because these buildings are so large and encompass such a large area, where one site starts and one site stops is sometimes a little bit of an issue.
There are many features that are so extraordinary and powerful in Chaco. Pueblo Bonito, which is, I believe, the largest structure there, is it right? It had about 800 rooms at one time?
Yeah, 800 is about right for Pueblo Bonito. The problem with Pueblo Bonito is it covers such a massive area, and the archaeologists about 20 years ago had discovered another large foundation that may in fact link both Chetroquetl and Pueblo Bonito together.
Mm.
So calling it Pueblo Bonito, what we call today Pueblo Bonito, can be a little bit misleading, because it's huge, and we really don't know the entire extent of this building.
The stonework as well tells a story.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Each individual block themselves, you can be rest assured, was shaped by human hands. 1,000 years ago, envision in your mind somebody taking another rock against the sandstone, chipping it at right angles, at very precise right angles, and then filling a wall that stretches 4 stories over top of your head. And it truly looks marvelous, like an artist's painting, or truly some of the finest masonry that you'll see in America today, where these people painstakingly glued these sandstone blocks together with mud mortar to make a facade of amazing stonework that's just monumental in scale.
How many people have been estimated to have lived there at its peak?
At its peak, you have, and this is one of the key areas of debate and research today, some people will say as many as 4,000 people lived in this canyon and built these buildings. Other people, based upon the environment and what you could grow here, suggest only roughly 400 to 500 people lived inside the canyon. Either case, they did something in this canyon that has never been replicated before or since.
It was quite a bit of a cultural trade center, sort of tying what I would believe the southern Mesoamerican communities up into the Pueblo cultures and the southwestern Pueblo cultures. Talk about some of the things that you found there that indicate the extent of that trade.
Well, the extent of the trade itself, you can see in the types of artifacts that were excavated out of some of the Great House ruins. You have a number of shells that come from the Gulf and Baja of California coasts. You have parrots, actually the physical bird, being transported all the way from Chihuahua and Sonoran. A great example of that is the blue and gold macaw coming from Sonora, Mexico. In some cases, you even have the scarlet macaw. A couple of skeletons were found inside of Pueblo Bonito. And the scarlet macaw comes from the Yucatan Peninsula of present-day Mexico.
And then, of course, there's a most unique feature, which is the sun dagger, which until relatively recently wasn't known about. But let's talk a little bit about the sun dagger.
Oh, certainly. The sun dagger is an archaeoastronomical marker first discovered by Anna Sofer as part of the Chaco Project. And the Chaco Project was an intense research period of field schools designed to really study the archaeology here in the canyon and really kind of determine what we have in Chaco. As part of this survey, they discovered the sun dagger, which consists of 3 large upright sandstone blocks, and the lighting of that would be of the sun, which shine through these blocks in such manner as to form a dagger of light. And this dagger of light pierces a spiral that was carved on the rock face 1,000 years ago that directly corresponds with the winter solstice and the summer solstice, as well as the equinoxes. So they, in effect, had a virtual calendar. And now we think of a calendar as something as, commonplace and everyday, but think of 1,000 years ago, living in the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, where you only have 120 days for growing your corn and providing food for your family. Having that precise measurement of when is the best time to plant your crops is absolutely critical to ensure the well-being of your family.
Right, the equinox point in that calendar would be the point at which the days began to lengthen. It's the change point, which is something that naturally inspires plants to grow. as a matter of fact, and flour. And then also there's quite a bit of speculation as to why they left. Why don't you tell us when they left? And there's a lot of theories.
There's a number of theories, more than we could ever get into. But as a whole, these people did not disappear. That's a common misnomer and a myth. The people exist today in Hopi, Acoma, Zuni, all the Pueblos along the Rio Grande River are descendant from the Chacon people. The reasons why they left, some claim that it was a massive drought. We know from tree ring dates that there was a 76-year period of intense drought. Also, because the plants are so respondent upon when it rains, the timing of that rainfall during that drought may have also forced them to move on to more perennial sources of water. Out here in the semi-arid southwest in the San Juan Basin, water is certainly the most precious commodity. If you don't have water, you can't live in this location. And without access to a readily supplyable source of water, these people would have to move on.
As we experience ourselves some what appear to be climatic changes due to potentially global warming, I certainly believe that that is the case. When we think about a 76-year drought, 76 years, we can see the stresses that that could create for a culture that is self-surviving.
Oh, certainly. You'd have to move. At 76 years, I'd be willing to say that not a single person lived to be 76 years old 1,000 years ago. So you're really talking about potentially three, maybe even four generations of people in that 76-year period. Undoubtedly, they would have to move or at least radically change their cultures to adapt to the changing environment.
Well, now let's kind of bring this to the point of all of this, and that is to say now as we look at the fall, and there are changes, and that obviously the changes that the animals, which I'd like to talk about, are going to have to experience as winter sets in, were also shared by the humans there, and I'm sure there were very similar considerations. So let's talk now about what you're noticing in terms of the changes that animals are having to make at this time of year, which is a time of change.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, 2 days ago, I was hiking out on the west boundary of Chaco near an archaeological site, and they came across three or four prairie rattlesnakes that were searching and looking for their hibernacula or their winter den. Typically, these types of reptiles you'll only see at the hottest point of the day at this time of year, around 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then they'll get underground so that they can stay warm. So they'll only be out for a short time. Other changes, a week ago, I was able to watch the departure of our turkey vultures that occur here in the canyon. We have a resident population of 14 to 15 individuals. That count is debated. And they started out by floating the thermals, or these air, rising air currents, higher and higher and higher until they were literally points of black against this brilliant blue sky of Chaco. And then as one, they headed off to the south. And they probably won't return until March of this next spring. Other changes, our migrants are starting to leave from the northern Colorado Rocky Mountains, and as they descend through New Mexico, sometimes they stop over in Chaco for a couple of days before they head on farther south. And I'm referring to birds like the grosbeaks and some of the mountain blues as they head back to their winter range here in Chaco. So it's a real exciting time.
How about coyotes and rabbits and noticing any changes amongst them? That may be pretty standard, but for example, cover starts to change for rabbits.
Well, certainly. Rabbits themselves, you'll see as the leaves fall off a lot of the shrubs, essentially their habitat cover from being preyed from raptors, they'll hide and cower underneath a lot of these bushes, certainly during the day, and you'll see them a little more active towards the evening hours as the light gets lower and lower in the sky. Their behavior isn't dramatically different from that of the summer, but they are more restricted in terms of where they can go from bush to bush. I saw a real interesting interaction with a coyote and a badger 4 days ago in the center of the park. This badger was following a coyote, and because that piqued my interest, I thought they were potentially in a fight, but it turns out they were in form of symbiosis, or a good positive relationship, where they would help each other dig out various bugs out of the ground, and then they would share these bugs. It was really interesting observation.
That's a great story. I like that. That's amazing. Was the badger kind of tracking along?
I thought they were in a fight. I thought the coyote pretty much ticked off the badger.
Well, that's easy to do.
And the badger was chasing, what I thought at first was chasing the coyote. But as they approached the top of the talus and they lost interest in me, I saw that they were digging around a lot of the bases of these greasewood plants and some of the saltbrush plants. And sure enough, as I went up there later after they left the area, I saw that they were both taking turns digging out the hole and then grabbing some of the bugs, and they didn't get them all. I did see some more down in the bottom of the hole.
It
was really interesting stuff.
How about cougars and bears?
Cougars and bears in Chaco Canyon are very, very rare. Occasionally they'll come through, but only under extreme duress or distress. Bears, in the case of a fire like we had in the Jemez Mountains a little more than 3 or 4 years ago, we had a few bears come through. We occasionally will have a mountain lion, but mostly in Chaco Canyon we have bobcat, resident population of bobcat.
Also, yeah, you have a lot of little ground squirrels of various sorts there. Are they caching things away?
Absolutely. At this time of year, everyone's active. At least all the animals are. Certainly the smaller mammals, the pack rats, the ground squirrels, are going out and grabbing as many sources of food as they can to store for the long winter. That's nothing unusual. You can find that anywhere across the United States this time of year.
So tell me what you think, and I'll let you speculate. I know you're not supposed to too much because you must maintain your scientific objectivity. But I welcome the opportunity to hear what you think about when you think about this time of year and the people of the Chaco culture and what they may have been considering or thinking about or doing at this time of year when the Chaco culture was thriving.
1,000 years ago, I can envision in my head and truly speculate because no one really knows for sure. I can envision families, you know, storing things away for the long winter ahead. I can see them getting their houses ready. I can see them gathering the firewood necessary to keep their fires going throughout the long winter. I can see them start to tell stories as Orion rises higher in the sky towards midnight. I can see them relate and pass on oral traditions of clan migrations over time in the canyon. I can see the education of the young ones continue. I can see the education of the medicinal societies that more than likely existed in Chaco Canyon continue. I can see them wrap up their crops and store away their seed sources for the next spring so that they can have a successful harvest a year from now. All of these things were undergoing in Chaco Canyon, and it's kind of comforting to think that not a lot has changed because a lot of the rural farmers in the United States today are doing the same sorts of things.
One of the elements that makes Chaco so fascinating is the artwork, particularly on the utensils, the cups in particular. This may have been a time when they spent a lot of time sitting around creating art.
Yes, definitely. I could easily see a group of potters gathering up their pottery and getting it ready to fire by slowly and methodically painting these paintings with nothing more than a yucca fiber brush and some hematite that is ground iron from the rocks, and then firing it in a nice kiln. They're very, very skilled in any craft they undertook here 1,000 years ago. And we look back and think, wow, they were doing this with rocks. They were doing this with their hands. They were doing this with the plants. And it really puts it into perspective.
One of the things that fascinates me, I spent extended time in Mesa Verde, where they have an extraordinary collection. And I'm not familiar with the actual collection that you have at Chaco, but I do know that when a person gets into really has an opportunity to see the extent of the artifacts, that you realize that these people had an enormous variety of tools and creations, clothing elements, mats, all sorts of things. And that leads me to always encourage people to try to expand their thinking. So oftentimes when people think of Southwestern cultures, Native American cultures, and I mean this respectfully,
but people tend to think of them as little brown-skinned people in loincloths. These were not little brown-skinned people in loincloths. Just as any other culture, and this was truly, as you say, a metropolis, there were an enormous amount of things that were required for those people to survive. And I encourage people when they visit Chaco, for example, to really take a look and try to imagine all of the tools. Tell me about your opportunity to kind of see the collections. I haven't seen the collections at Chaco. What do you find?
Well, the collections are huge and massive. We have over a couple million artifacts in curation right now, and they range from wood beams that are useful for gathering dates from the sites to bone tools that were used for poking holes in leather or buckskin of elk or deer. And you see everything from bracelets and artwork and macaws to copper bells. So you have the entire gamut of tools necessary for everyday living to some really special things that you don't find anywhere else other than Chaco. You find painted boards. You find all kinds of things, all of which can, a portion of which, I should say, can be seen on the Internet today through the Chaco's webpage.
Oh, well, let's talk about that.
You can access Chaco's webpage at www.nps.gov/CHCU, Chaco Culture National Historical Park.
Well, I'm going to spend some real time there because the Chaco culture fascinates me. I'm sure it will fascinate anybody. I guarantee it will fascinate anybody. If it doesn't, I don't know where you've been all your life. It's well worth a visit. We've been talking with Brad Shattuck, who's the Chief of Natural Resources at Chaco Culture National Historical Park. Brad, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
My pleasure. Great honor to be here.
Take time to sense the wonder of the natural world and the intelligence, creativity, and strength of the natural systems. Stay with us now after a short break to learn how your creativity may just help to save the world and put a big check in your bank when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.